Hello, Bill.
Good morning, Matt.
Welcome to the DMZ, everybody.
Did you have a good Memorial Day weekend?
It was a little mellow, Bill, partly because weather here, you know, it wasn't really pool or beach weather. We're talking low 70s, kind of cloudy. So I ended up watching some movies with the kids, for better or worse. And, you know, we did other stuff, too, like went for walks and all that stuff to get exercise, but pretty mellow. How about you?
Yeah, it was low key. I did some grilling. I think I've perfected my. I've already perfected my burger, Matt.
No doubt.
Because I will cook a whole mess of bacon, like 3/4 of the way, and then cut it up, and then mix it in with the meat. So any kind of burger mistake you make, like is already like offset by the addition of bacon.
Now, is this with propane and propane accessories, or do you do charcoal?
You know, I have both at home, and I have been using my charcoal more than my propane. But I went to a friend's house and they were using propane.
Taste the meat, not the heat. Yeah. That's what I always say.
And I think I've perfected my, onion caramelization technique. So I can do like 2 Vidalia onions in the cast iron skillet, no oil, covered, and let that go for a couple hours, you know, with the periodic, you know, stirring around.
You're making me hungry, Bill. We took my wife's grandfather, Inslee Hicks, turned 101 on May 22nd. So we took him to this cool restaurant where they brought out, they have like, they call it pigs on a clothesline or something. So they bring out bacon hanging off of clothespins, and they have like some sort of a, it's not a flamethrower, a blowtorch. Like, is there a cooking blowtorch thing?
It was like creme brulees, you see that.
Yeah. And they cook, I don't know if it's like pre-baked and then they like, you know, blacken it, but it was amazing.
This Memorial Day weekend is also almost always my oldest daughter's birthday. So we have fallen into a routine for kid birthdays that we do hibachi. So we had a lot of flames.
Yes. The knives flying and the egg and the,
yeah. Although they didn't even like eat the hibachi. They ordered sushi. Both my kids ordered sushi. The rest of us had hibachi. But they like the show.
So much left over too, right?
Yeah.
So
not when I do it, but other people, yes.
So I do have to say,
you went out to the movies, right, Matt?
Well, we did. So I saw one movie at home, and then I went to the theater. So at home, I watched Air. This is the movie about how Nike got Michael Jordan to sign on to do Air Jordans, which I would highly recommend.
There's no depiction of Michael Jordan in it, correct?
No, and that was one of my concerns going in. I heard that it was it's a little weird to have a movie ostensibly about Michael Jordan, and yet he's actually not in it. But frankly, I think it was a smart move. I think it works. I think they pulled it off. I think it works. It would have been weirder to have an actor playing the young Michael Jordan, in my opinion. And it's smart. It's well done. I actually watched it with my kids. I would say if you watch it, there is one scene where so what happens is, I don't think this is a huge spoiler, but I think it's Matt Damon. As they've gotten older, I tend to get Matt Damon and Leonardo DiCaprio confused nowadays. They've merged into one identity. It's bizarre how that happened, but I think it's Matt Damon. He plays sort of like a middle manager at Nike who's in charge of the basketball division. And he tries to go after Michael Jordan, which Jordan wants to be with Adidas, you know, Adidas and Converse were the cool brands at that point. And he kind of has to go over the head or around the agent. And there's a scene where the agent puts on the whole Ari Emanuel thing of just unleashing profanity. That would make a sailor blush. And that was certainly not appropriate for my little ears in the house. Otherwise, a good movie. I give it thumbs up from me, you know, Bill.
So I watched I made the bold decision, I think over the weekend, it wasn't too long ago, to watch When Harry Met Sally with my 11-year-old.
Oh, the orgasm scene, yes.
Right. Well, because we're watching Schmigadoon on Apple TV, and there was a brief orgasm reference in season 2. And she was like, "What's an orgasm?" And I was like, "God, I can't do anything. I can't watch like a movie musical show without something." And I just kind of sloughed it off. I was like, "It's a sex thing," and she didn't push the point. So I felt like, okay, we already crossed that line.
Because a lot of times at a certain point, there are references that just go over their heads.
Yeah,
and you don't have, you know, the dad can enjoy it, mom can enjoy it, and the kids. They don't, it doesn't even bother them because they're not even aware.
There's definitely, but I mean, I watch a lot of stuff with my younger daughter, and she's a big questioner. And plus, the way kids watch things these days, you know, everything they see is on demand. You know, they don't know what it's like to like just, I mean, actually, they have been to a movie theater, but it's rare. They don't watch live TV, you know, they watch everything is streaming. So, they're primed to like interrupt everything and ask every question and get up to get a drink or get a snack or go to the bathroom. Like there's never a sense like I have to just like sit and pay attention or else I will miss it.
But I would say my kids are big questioners too. And I think it really provides an opportunity for teachable moments, you know, where we'll watch something, stop it. And then I'll talk, we'll have a whole discussion about it.
Like that happens at times. The times I'm happy at the teachable moment. Sometimes I'm like, we just watch the show. Just like
I'm waiting for the day when we stop it and they explain things to me.
Well,
Dad, a reverse Nelson is not what you think it is. You know, something like that.
I just feel like when I show them older things, like they were made to be watched.
Yes.
You know, they require your attention because there's buildup to a payoff. If you're constantly cutting in, like you miss stuff.
Definitely.
Or the jokes don't land.
I back it up, you know?
I mean, I back it up too, but just the rhythm is always a little off. And I feel like you're really never getting the experience.
So I took my kids to see, we went to the theaters. So I took my wife and my kids. This is just my kids. They would want to go see like Guardians of the Galaxy or something, right? But since the wife was coming, we went to a nice lunch, and then we go to the movies, and we went to see this movie. It's called About My Father, About My Dad. It's such a...
That's the new De Niro?
About My Father, rated PG-13. And it's... there's a comedian, Sebastian Maniscalco, who's... I'm not that familiar with his work, but he's like a younger Italian comedian. He plays the son. Robert De Niro's the dad. And the son becomes engaged to sort of this rich, waspy girl. And so the son brings his embarrassing dad, Bobby De Niro, along to their rich house. And I thought it's, you know, we've seen it before, right? It's a little Meet the Fockers. I would argue better. I liked it better. So this movie's been it's gotten some criticism. There's a lot of narration. It's sort of a little bit of a spoof on Goodfellas, I think, in that regard, where the son narrates it. He sounds a little like Joe Pesci, like in Goodfellas. Mm-hmm. So there's a little spoof on that. I like narration. I'm not a lot of people hate it. I thought it really worked. I don't think it's Citizen Kane, but if you're looking for something fun to see. And I would also say there were a couple moments where they kind of went to the line on whether I was going to be embarrassed to be there with my kids. And they went right to the line and didn't cross it. So thumbs up. And I would say take your 12-year-old to see this. That's fine.
Well, I didn't go to the movies, but my wife took my youngest to see Are You There, God? It's Me, Margaret, at the theater, which is the first theater experience I've had in a while. And again, I can't speak for it directly, but everyone gave it a thumbs up. I'm sure that's what you want to take your kids to, Matt. That's next on your list.
Let me just bring this up, because you may be the only person who may know this reference because of your love for for parodies in Weird Al Yankovic.
Yeah.
Are you familiar with the stylings of Ray Stevens?
Familiar, yes.
Do you know the song It's Me Again, Margaret?
I don't know that song.
Okay. It's not that good. It's not one of his hits. It's a song about a pervert who is like calls up women. And it totally would not play in 2023.
Yeah, I think a lot of Ray Stevens would not play today. Yes.
Hello, Margaret. It's me again, Margaret. It's worth a listen for you just to put. But every time I see anything about that movie and there's like a hashtag like it's me again, Margaret or something like that, I'm like, I just that song, what I haven't heard since 1984, comes rushing back in along with the, you know, Mississippi Squirrel Revival and the Haircut Song and the Blue Cyclone. And I grew up listening to a lot of country stuff, Bill, including Ray Stevens.
I never really got into Ray Stevens. And, you know, growing up in the North, it wasn't something like, you know, kids didn't pass around Ray Stevens the way they passed around, you know, Weird Al or in later years, Two Live Crew.
You went to a different school than I did, apparently. You didn't go to the kind of school that got out for hunting season, did you?
No, that's, that's not what happened. But I remember Ray Stevens TV ads.
Mm.
Like this old K-Tel, like, you know, Ray Stevens and the title scroll up the screen and everything. And I was like, who the hell is Ray Stevens? That's like my sole Ray Stevens exposure.
All right. Before we move on, I have not seen Succession finale. I saw the first couple
of
seasons.
I'm not seeing Succession at all. I am caught up on Ted Lasso.
Well, that's what I wanted to bring up because as fans of our DMZ army out there know, you and I dressed up as Ted Lasso and Beard for Halloween.
Yes.
And it's you can go to youtube.com/Matt Lewis and see. I thought we looked pretty good.
But you fell off the wagon, apparently.
Well, no. So here's what happened, Bill. I know you're famous for being cheap and finding workarounds for firewalls and stuff.
I am paying for Apple TV.
Well, I'm not, but here's the deal. I got a new laptop 4 or 5 months ago, okay?
Okay.
And when you get a new Apple or a new Mac, they give you 3 months of Apple TV. So my wife and I just finished watching The Great. I don't know if you've seen this. It's about Catherine the Great. It's good. Not great, but it's good. It's on Hulu. Despite the name, it's good. So now we're ready to move into Ted Lasso, but we wanted to wait to start our 3 months at a time when we thought we could finish the whole Ted Lasso season, right? Because we're not going to binge watch it in one weekend. We're going to like watch an episode every week or every few days. So I just got signed on to Apple TV again. I just invoked my 3 month thing right for free. Now I have to cancel. Remind me to cancel it in August. Okay. If I haven't done it by then, please remind me. But the question is it worth? Because I felt like season one, great. Season two, hit or miss, right? I thought the Beard episode was utterly bizarre.
Mm-hmm.
But the Christmas episode was very good.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, without spoiling this, like, should I be looking forward to this or do I need to, like, you know, pull the plug now?
Well, we're taping Wednesday morning. I believe the finale drops today, and I think it's the series finale.
I think it is, yeah.
So I can't speak to the finale. You might have noticed there's been a bunch of commentary over the course of a few months of that sort of Ted Lasso has lost its way and it's not good anymore. And there was an Atlantic story about that didn't get a lot of traction. So I heard a lot of that on on Twitter and Facebook friends, people.
I mean, unhappy. You know, I have to say, Bill, to that point, I don't trust what anyone says, because if I had trusted, I read before I went to see this De Niro movie, you know, I read reviews and, you know, everyone's a critic.
My own take is it wasn't clicking for like the first 2/3 of the season, but it's now in a groove.
Okay,
the last 2-3 episodes, it's coming together very well, and I'm really now very looking forward to the finale. Of course, maybe they don't stick the landing. Finales are hard, but yeah. I do feel like they had a game plan, and it's coming together.
Good to hear. I hope it ends on a high note. Because that show really did mean something to people. It came out during COVID, and Ted Lasso provided this optimism and decency that was sorely needed.
Well, I think what's tricky about that show is, like, the first season was like, look, nice people, hooray. And they clearly wanted to be more than just that. There had to be some conflicts. There had to be emotional ups and downs. And, you know, trying to, like, keep that going over a long period of time is not easy. And
hey, so, you're talking to someone who's been involved in a 12 to 15 year drama weekly on a show called The DMZ. So I know what it's like keeping people interested.
Right. So I think in the first half or so, like there weren't a lot of humorous payoffs. It was getting kind of maudlin, and so it wasn't fun. So I think people were sort of looking for their shot of niceness and feel-good moments. They weren't getting that on the front end.
You know who else needs niceness and a feel-good moment? The American public, as we careen toward a debt crisis. And it seems like, I don't want to compare Kevin McCarthy to Ted Lasso, but he could be America's, you know, hero. What do you think?
So you think McCarthy deserves more of the credit than Biden?
I think he's going to get more credit than Biden. I'm not sure who deserves the credit. And it's premature, just like the final episode of Ted Lasso, which has not aired yet. The final episode of the debt ceiling has not been told as well.
Well, I think they're definitely going to stick the landing. This is going to be pretty smooth. I mean, when they started negotiations in earnest to when they announced their deal, 18 days. This has been the smoothest negotiation process of the entire Biden presidency. It took them like a year and a half to get to a deal with Manchin on reconciliation. After everything, you know, falling apart, having to go to their respective quarters for several months, like talking trash by each other through dueling statements. So, look, McCarthy deserves credit here. I don't mean to be, you know,
he's up. I think he's up like 10 points in terms of his popularity.
Well, let's see some data after this is really settled in. I think there was one poll that came out, but I don't even know when the dates of that poll were taken. I think you want to assess this once there's a final vote and a week has passed, and let's see where people's numbers are.
Well, my question for you, let me just ask this question, because I think we were all assuming that McCarthy would be a weak speaker, and that because the Republicans are so crazy and so performative and so ornery, and because McCarthy's majority was so slim, that he wouldn't be able to negotiate in good faith. He would come to Biden and say, let's do a deal. And then they would cut his legs out from under him. Mm-hmm. That hasn't happened. Why?
Well, look, you go. I wrote about this in February, Matt, at the Washington Monthly, where I said, McCarthy wants a deal. He's not looking to make this complicated. He's not looking to blow up the economy. He wants to get out of this. He realizes the debt limit is not leverage. The debt limit is a hand grenade, and you don't want to blow up in your hands. He knows he's a tenuous majority. He knows he's got, you know, Biden district members on the left, and he's got Freedom Caucus nut jobs on the right, and only, you know, a 5-vote cushion to spare. So he's looking to escape this predicament.
Yeah.
And by February, this is not all that long after he won the gavel, after that whole drama, where he ostensibly promised the Freedom Caucus types that he would push for a 10-year balanced budget, which one of those things that sort of sounds innocuous, but in fact would involve a lot of really, you know, steep cuts. By February, he was already not doing that. There was no indication he was calling for a 10-year balanced budget. He was calling to negotiate with Biden, essentially with no preconditions beyond cutting spending in some amorphous way. And when he was doing that in February, not a peep out of the Freedom Caucus. So that said to me, right then and there, okay, these Freedom Caucus guys, they're chumps, they're bluffers, they're not giving McCarthy pressure. Now, maybe if you wait too long, they'd get their gumption and make things harder for McCarthy. So I was sort of, I wasn't firm about this, but I was sort of suggesting to Biden, hey, maybe you should just talk now before the right wing gets, you know, dug in.
It just seems though, like, you know how like a dog can smell fear or a shark can decide who they want to attack, you know, who they're going to make a victim. It just seems like if John Boehner had been there or Paul Ryan, they would have turned on him and he
I mean, Boehner had to quit. Like Boehner literally had to like leave the job just to keep the government open because the Freedom Caucus types were about to go ballistic over defunding Planned Parenthood.
Now it's possible that Trump's presidency taught the Freedom Caucus people that they don't really care about debt and deficits, and that that changed them, and therefore getting spending cuts. I'm searching for a reason why this worked.
Look, I mean, it's true that Republicans don't give Republican presidents a hard time with the debt ceiling. But I think that's not, I think it's too pat to say that it means that they don't care about debt deficits at all. It's just harder for them to push the point when it's their guy. You know, so you do get grumbling about it, you know, when there's a Republican president, but they obviously don't go to DEFCON 1.
We don't know. It sounds like we don't know why McCarthy has been given this leverage caucus.
Well, here's my opinion. Obviously, I can't be a minor. Here's my opinion. And this comes back to the fact that McCarthy won the gavel at all, which, you know, I mentioned at the time with you. I felt like they had him pinned and they let him get up. And people said, well, they didn't have an alternative. And I was like, so what? If they were true nihilists, if they just didn't care at all about the ramifications of anything, they would just let everything grind to a halt for weeks and months and force everyone else to let the baby have their bottle. You come to me with a speaker candidate that I will accept, but I get the final say. I have the veto power. They had that power and they gave it up. And my conclusion from that is they don't want to own anything.
So they are rational actors.
They're grandstanders, they're attention seekers, but to actually take it to that level where it's your speaker and it's your default, but think about everything that follows from that point forward, and they don't have the spine to own it all.
But the problem, one of the systemic problems that we've had for years, certainly within the Republican Party, is kind of this tragedy of the commons problem, this game theory whereby it may be in the best interest of the Republican Party to prevent default and to appear competent, but it's not necessarily in the best interest of Matt Gaetz or Marjorie Taylor Greene or Lauren Boebert. Their best interest, they may be, I don't want to say nihilist, but they may be rational actors and wanting to push things to the precipice. And yet for whatever reason now, and I know there are going to be some people who, McCarthy's not going to get 100% of his coalition, right? There'll be some standouts, but by and large, the Republican Party is coming together, backing kind of a moderate, sensible, they're winning. Don't get me wrong. I don't think Biden gets anything except to say he gets an economy that's not collapsing.
What? And nothing.
It's not nothing. And he gets to avoid this fight, right, for two more years until after his reelection. But substantively, I mean, am I correct that, you know, Republicans didn't get everything they wanted, but every change that was made is a change that Republicans would want?
I don't fully agree with that. On a macro sense, you know, some Democrats are happy that in this work requirements deal, where for SNAP benefits, food stamps, yes, Republicans increase the age where the work requirements kick in from 49 to 54. But that was paired with an exemption for work requirements for veterans and homeless, which the CBO scores as being a net gain for people getting food stamps. And the Republicans who were for the deal said, oh, CBO's wrong. It's not going to be a net gain. So it's not even like they were recoiling at the CBO score. Oh, no, this didn't work out the way we planned. They both are telling the completely opposite narratives about what occurred. But there are some Democrats who are genuinely pleased that Biden, you know, pulled that rabbit out of the hat. But that's more narrow. I think more broadly, there's two things that Biden really gets out of this. One is, I don't think he minds her being a spending cut at all. He didn't want it to be too big. But, and I wrote about this previously, this is not 2011. This is not unemployment at 9% coming out of one of the biggest recessions of all time and still having a need to stimulate demand to get the economy back on its feet. We're in an inflationary economy with record low unemployment. Demand is not the issue. And Biden still wants inflation to come down from a year-over-year figure of around 5% to more like 3% probably. I mean, obviously, you'd love it to be 2%, but I'm sure he'd take 3.5%. As long as there's some downward movement there that people can start to feel, that's going to put him in fantastic shape in 2024. And if he can get that and say, well, these Republicans have made me do it, then that's all going to work out for him. And then layer on top of that, this is the guy that ran in 2020 of the guy being the guy who's going to make Washington work, who's going to revive a spirit of bipartisanship, to not look at the other party as being your fundamental enemy. He gave that address at Gettysburg in October 2020. And this is not a one-off. I mean, we already had infrastructure. We had Ukraine aid. We've had gun safety. We even had postal service reform, for Pete's sake. And we've not had any shutdown or any debt default. He is the first president since Gerald Ford to not have any, to not have one day of a shutdown. And some of those shutdowns, you know, like for Carter and Reagan, were very brief. But we've had more significant ones under Obama and even under Trump and under Bill Clinton and Newt Gingrich. And look, we got a couple years left here, but once you have a two-year budget agreement, the chances for a shutdown when you hit the fiscal year deadline at the end of September is a whole lot less likely. So I think Biden is very well positioned to say to the public, I told you I could get Washington to work again, we could work together, and I did it. Whereas if he was going to go pull a 14th Amendment and have that be litigated and maybe have a period of default in the interim, you know, that wouldn't fit with that narrative. So I think Biden gets something out of this.
All right. So before we move on, I just want to let me just lay down my marker for my general take on this whole thing. Number one, I think we need to cut spending. I think, you know, obviously we need to cut spending. The devil's in the details, but I'm glad that we're cutting it to a certain extent. We probably need to cut it a lot more. Number two, I think the debt ceiling is stupid.
Yeah.
You know, we need to cut it during budgeting, when we're budgeting, not this sort of emergency thing.
I wrote a piece 2 years ago where I said, I mean, so you can, in reconciliation, which is the way to circumvent the filibuster, you're going to use reconciliation for budgetary things. It's not supposed to be for policy changes. So you can't write, the debt limit doesn't exist anymore. You can't do that in reconciliation. But you could say the debt limit is now $1 billion. Like you can do that and make it so high that it becomes meaningless. And so they had the power to do that. They didn't seem to really have tried to do it. I mean, there's been some reporting of why didn't they? And you don't really get a very clear answer beyond like maybe Manchin wasn't for it.
It would be a TV ad, right? That Republicans.
I mean, that would be the Occam's razor explanation. But I think you can make the number so ridiculous that it wouldn't even make sense to be in an ad. You know, I mean, you do the ad, but like whatever. And Democrats could have said, look, these debt limit things are stupid and they cause all this anxiety and they make the markets go haywire. And so we ended that.
Yeah.
I mean, I think you'd have a
case. Just own it. I mean, I don't think that's going to cost you.
They already did the spending. I mean, in 2022, like the spending already occurred. Yes. They already had huge spending. They had high inflation. What's the debt limit on top of that? You know, whatever. So I would have done that. And I think they should still do that given the chance. But having said that, because you see in some corners of the Democratic Party now an upset that this legitimizes hostage taking, that the Republicans were rewarded for this tactic again, and they're going to keep doing it now. And I don't think that's right, because I don't think this is really I don't think McCarthy did a true hostage taking maneuver. You know, when Newt Gingrich in 95 says, you sign our Republican passed budget, with cuts to Medicare and cuts to Medicaid and cuts to education environment, you sign this exact bill or the government shuts down and we default on the debt. Like, that's a hostage. That's do this or the economy gets it. You know, when Ted Cruz said you defund Obamacare or the economy gets it, like, that's hostage taking. You know, McCarthy said, I don't want default. I want to negotiate with you. You know, here's an offer, but let's talk. That's not the same thing. And look, and this happened 4 years ago with Pelosi. You might see these clips of Donald Trump saying that the debt limit's a sacred thing and no one should ever negotiate with it. That's because Pelosi was holding out because she wanted to raise spending. Because, I mean, it gets a little bit in the budget weeds. You know, we have that sequester coming out of the 2011 debt limit deal, but Congress was essentially overriding it with budget caps that went above the sequester levels. Those caps were about to expire in 2019. So Pelosi wanted to bump them back up again. And she said, we're going to do this in the debt limit bill, or we're not going to pass the debt limit. And that's what they did. You know, she didn't say, you got to do this exact number or I destroy everything. But that was just part of what became a fairly normal negotiation. And they came to a modest budget agreement, as has happened now with Biden and McCarthy. So I don't think you can argue if Democrats did nuke the debt limit 2 years ago and you were having this negotiation in September when the fiscal year is about to end, they have to get the government open, you probably get the same deal. Because there's no provision here where you say it's only because of the debt limit that Biden had to accept this. Because the government shutdown's a thing too. There's points of leverage in there. So I think this is well within the realm of a normal agreement that you'd expect with the presidency and the House and different parties. And they have to do something that's, you know, not perfectly pleasant for everybody, but doesn't totally upset the apple cart.
All right. Well, on that happy note, let's move to the Republican primary, where we've had some movement since we last spoke. And by the way, Bill, you and I spoke, the last time we did a DMZ was the day that DeSantis announced.
Right.
So we didn't even, you know, get to talk about the Twitter Spaces debacle and all that.
Right.
I think that's probably old news by now. But DeSantis was in Iowa yesterday, last night.
Yep.
Still not mentioning Donald Trump's name, but definitely coming after him much harder than we've seen before from DeSantis. Simultaneously, there is now reporting that Chris Christie will be getting in the race, I think, next week. So it seems like we could be seeing the fighting. The Donald Trump is now going to have some people actually throwing some elbows at him in the next few weeks. What do you think?
DeSantis, we talked about DeSantis not going at Trump hard enough, trying to be too cute about it, you know, being too surgical about it. And I'll say that he has gone at him on certain things I wasn't expecting. I wasn't expecting him to say that Trump supported an amnesty, for example, that Trump went too left on criminal justice reform. You know, those things I wasn't expecting. But it's still in the realm of
More of the Ted Cruz mistake, potentially, right?
Yeah, I still don't really. I mean, we'll see how the numbers look.
That you can beat Trump by demonstrating that he's not ideologically pure enough.
Yeah,
right.
And I am very skeptical that's going to work. I mean, we'll see numbers in a few weeks, see if he gets traction out of it. I mean, and he might get a certain bump because just he's in the news more.
And maybe it works in Iowa, but I don't think it works nationally.
Yeah,
okay, but that's okay. Obviously, he's putting a lot on Iowa. That's a big. But again, Ted Cruz won Iowa, so you know.
I just think you have to. He's still operating on the premise that this is a Trumpy party, and I got to be Trumpy myself, and I have sort of to out Trump Trump. I mean, again, this is all mixed with things like, oh, I'll look at pardoning the January Sixers. I saw one, I think it was the National News, and I was like, whoa, you know, you're misreading that because he said he would do it case by case, and that's what anyone should do. I'm like, yeah, but he should be saying that this was an abomination of democracy.
Yeah.
And these guys are fascist, and, you know, sure, I'll look at a case to see if someone was perhaps wrongly accused, but January 6th was a travesty. He's not doing that. He still wants to be in good with the part of the Republican base that is okay with what happened on January 6th. I mean, he was talking about people being convicted because of a weaponized Justice Department, which feeds into all the conspiracy theories. So he's not going at everything about Trumpism. And look, you could argue that doing so would be bad politically short term because it is a Trumpy party. I just don't think you beat Trump if it remains a Trumpy party. You have to change the field. You have to change the landscape if you're going to beat Trump. You got to convince some of those sovereign Trump people that this path we're on is a bad path, electorally and morally. And that requires a more comprehensive critique about what's going on.
So I had a piece that came out on The Beast. I think it came out the Sunday before Memorial Day. So it just got buried. It didn't get any traction. And honestly, I'm not sure I'm quite, it's an idea that's like a nascent idea of mine. But, you know, Trump in many ways built a cult, and it's a very loyal cult. And he never cared about, you know, politics being a game of addition. He never cared about persuasion. Trump is very focused on his fan base and on motivating them and keeping them loyal. And that turns out to have been very effective. This passion and loyalty has been very effective in terms of imposing discipline, keeping people in line. And it turns out you can actually win the presidency with a plurality. You don't need to have a majority. And so it's worked for Trump. But the interesting thing is that DeSantis seems, I'm just basing it off of his announcement, that Twitter Spaces thing that we alluded to earlier, DeSantis is kind of doing a similar move, right? Like, I think conventional wisdom would suggest that Ron DeSantis should be doing two things. Number one, trying to win back the Reagan coalition. Number two, trying to peel off some Trump supporters who want a winner, who want a more competent, right winger. And that would presumably be a coalition, like a large enough coalition to possibly win the primary and possibly win the presidency. DeSantis instead seems to be like building his own cult. He is going for these, a post-liberal, common good, right wing, like Elon Musk, Josh Hawley. Like, I don't even know what to call this, but these are intellectuals who want to use the force of government to impose their view of the common good. And that's not Joe Sixpack in Des Moines. That's not your average Joe. Most people don't know what DEI is, right? That's what DeSantis was, that's the rhetoric he was using.
I think this should be your North Star in your coverage of the Republican primary over the next year. Because I believe presidential primaries, in my opinion, are great. Everyone always complains about them. Oh, they take too long. Why can't we be like Britain and do it like in a day? They're so boring, and it's all this repetitive debates and horse race coverage. One, you want to vet people. You don't want people to just show up on a week and like not know what kind of grifter nonsense they've been involved in. It takes time to vet people properly. So I think you want to kick the tires. But relevant to what we're talking about here, I think primaries teach you about the parties. You learn the complexity of parties, even if it's your party. Like you may not know what tectonic plates have shifted in your own party until you see these inter-party conflicts play out over the course of weeks and months. And I think we're seeing like in the Democratic Party for a long time, it's been established that there's a wine track and a beer track. And we have this long history of wine track candidates going, you know, Gary Hart in 1984 and 88, not so much in 88, Paul Tsongas in 92, Bill Bradley in 2000, Howard Dean in 2004, Obama was sort of the one wine tracker that pulled it off it was sort of wine track plus African-Americans. And then in 2016, in 2020, Buttigieg was really the wine tracker, although Warren had some of that too. That was really about 2020. You saw like divisions within the wine track lane, based on, you know, age and ideology. So you learn, and of course, with the rise of Bernie Sanders, there is this whole, you know, Gen Y, Gen Z contingent of the party that didn't exist before that was far more socialistic than what we had seen in other Democratic primaries, which is, it materialized because there was generational shifts happening. So I think we're seeing the beginnings of a, you know, Trump, post-Trump Republican version of a wine track. Like, whereas you might have thought Republican wine track is like a John Huntsman. Now this wine track is Elon Musk-y. It's get deep in the weeds of crypto policy and DEI and talk about like the woke mind virus and that sort of thing. And I don't know if we fully have our arms around like what really is the connective tissue of that constituency, but I do think DeSantis is representative of that. And, you know, the open question is that enough to actually win a primary? You and I think probably not. It's probably like a Democratic wine track. It's not enough by itself. Like Obama, you got to pair it with something else to be a true coalition. But, you know, 2016 shows that the Republican coalition is a lot different than what people thought it was. It's not the same place that would nominate Mitt Romney in 2012. Yeah.
But the barrier of entry into MAGA is pretty low. You know, you own some camo gear. You go to Walmart. I don't know. Like the barrier of entry is pretty low. I think to get into this new wine track, as we are now, you know, I think Matthew Continetti had a piece where he talked about the DeSantis doctrine. Mm-hmm. We'll call it the new wine track. The barrier of entry there is pretty high, right? And so it just seems our theory that this is not a large enough coalition to base your freaking campaign announcement around. Didn't use the F word exactly. not going to do it. I think our theory is pretty sound based on the.
Well, look, I mean, it's better to start with a niche constituency than start with nothing. You know, he has money, he has demonstrable support. He can fill a room. He's breaking double digits in polls. You know, what's weird about DeSantis is that he was seen more as a broadly appealing candidate, not a niche candidate. So I think he's sort of fallen backwards from where the perception was, which is not ideal. But being niche is okay to start with, so long as you have a game plan to eventually broad. I mean, that's always the hard, why wine track Democrats always have a hard time is that transition. I mean, Paul Tsongas pulled off a string of wins early on and then hit a brick wall in the South, because at that point, the Southern Democrat was not just African Americans, it was also white working class. And neither constituency was leading that into these candidates that were appealing to, you know, white college educated types.
That's just to drill down on it. I mean, that's what we're talking about here. Like DeSantis's base, based on his announcement on Twitter Spaces, having Elon Musk be part of that announcement, we're talking about younger white college educated tech bros who are very online and know what DEI stands for. Mm-hmm. Right. And like, again, I think there's got to be a whole bunch of people who go to evangelical churches and shop at Walmart who are going to vote for Trump who do not fit into that very small niche.
Now, I don't know how much this is going to matter as far as Republican politics is concerned, but I do find a hallmark of this Republican wine track constituency is, I'm sure it's heavily male, number one, and it's heavily mansplainy, number two. There's a lot of like, we are so much smarter than the rest of you. Yeah. And even though like you get a lot of your own facts wrong, Elon Musk gets stuff wrong all the time.
You can't even keep Twitter Spaces up. But I think you're right about that. And the thing is though, it's deceiving, right? Because if you're very online and you look at like how many people watch Steven Crowder, it's like, I don't know, millions of YouTube views and Twitter, like how many people watch Charlie Kirk or what? Like, they have a huge online following. And I think it creates this sense that they have a majority. And really, there aren't that many people, if you put it in context. Mm-hmm. It's not enough. Like, so if you're trying to create a coalition that would win the Republican primary, why would you start and be so focused on a losing a minority group? Now, I understand that movements oftentimes start off with some a very small number of dedicated. Jesus had 12 disciples in the beginning, right? You know, the communists, the you know, the Marxists, whatever, you know, in Russia, small cadre of elites. I get that that can happen. I'm just not sure it can happen between now and January.
Yeah, you know, Trump warps everybody's perceptions because Trump didn't go broad. He was seemingly appealing to niche people, playing to hardcore base, not thinking about the general election, presumably. And it proved to be enough for one election. And so you can win a Republican primary with a plurality. You can pull off a fluky electoral college victory with having less popular votes if you have them in the right places. So it's hardly the kind of thing you want to really try to emulate because it's really slicing and very thin. But I think it confuses people's perceptions about what really are high probability strategies. And look, it's hard because he's in the race. Trump's in the race and he's hoarding a lot of voters.
And so, he's still talking about ending birthright citizenship. He's attacking Kayleigh McEnany, his former press secretary, for a poll that Fox, I guess, put out that didn't have him up as much as he thought he was up over it. Like Trump is still doing interesting, weird things that are meant not to unite. He's a divider, not a uniter. I mean, the opposite of what George W. Bush would have said, which is speaks to the fact that everything we thought we knew about politics is changing, right? You would think that it's about addition, not subtraction. You would think it's about holding on to your base, but simultaneously trying to grow the coalition. I mean, DeSantis seemed certainly in his announcement, and I think that's symbolic of something, seemed to be suggesting that the key is having a small, fired up base who are really loyal and very into your thing, that's more important than sort of, in other words, it's not broadcasting, it's narrowcasting.
Well, I assume they hope that they'll give him enough amplification of his message that he can be heard. He'll get the media coverage. He can get his message points out and that can help bring over people from the Trump campaign. For this birthright citizenship thing. So here's Trump saying, if I'm president, I'm going to have an executive order. We're not going to have birthright citizenship anymore. And this is because I think it's also 14th Amendment. It's one of the, you know, post-Civil War amendments that says, you know, essentially if you were born here, you're a citizen. And, you know, the hardcore anti-immigrant folks have not wanted interpreted that way. And just want to assert that that's not how we're going to interpret it anymore. And so DeSantis responds, I think it was him himself. I don't think it was a statement. I think he said at some point, that he could have done this when he was president. But if he can do an executive order, why didn't he do it? You know, this is sort of,
but to me, that is more, by the way, I think that's the more effective kind of attack from DeSantis, as opposed to trying to out ideologically pure Trump.
But I think it's part of the same thing. He's trying to say you weren't anti-immigrant enough.
No. He's trying to say, if you think that building a wall is the key, why didn't you do it? You had 4 years. It's about competence, Bill. And I think it's a way. Now, he's using your right to a certain degree. And I think that provides a permission structure for DeSantis to make this charge. But fundamentally, it's about Trump being ineffective. And DeSantis, if you look at what he said in Iowa, his point is like, I'll actually get it done. And if you're a liberal, you may be like, oh my gosh, that's really freaking scary. He actually may get it done. Selling point.
I talked about this last week, so I won't rehash it, but I do have a piece about the Monthly say how DeSantis has not been competent. So feel free to check that out.
He's not been competent by your definition of success,
yeah.
But he has been competent if your goal is to wage a culture war and to take on corporations and local public officials, then he has bet. He hasn't always won. You're right. I mean, Disney is, that ain't over, right?
Right, right.
But he's at least waging the war in a way that I think Trump rhetorically talks about all these things and doesn't do anything.
Well, but I think this is the exact point. I think the average Republican voter does not care about how exactly the policies get executed. They care about how hard are you fighting. And Trump is the consummate fighter, which is why it's so hard to say you weren't anti-immigrant enough. I'm like, are you kidding me? I saw this guy attack judges for being Hispanic. I saw this guy call people coming over the border rapists. I saw him separate families and put them in cages. Like, he's everything an anti-immigrant person could want. What do you mean he's not executing the policy perfectly? I was there in his presidency. He made liberal heads explode over these things. And that's all I care about, is watching their heads explode.
And by the way, I don't know if you saw, about a week ago, Jeff Rowe, who is the top strategist for DeSantis's super PAC, essentially said something to the, I'm paraphrasing here, it was in Politico, I believe, but he said, like, we're going to beat Donald Trump by beating Donald Trump. And he kind of went on to say, by showing that we are better fighters and more competent at doing the things Trump said he wanted to do. And, you know, again, paraphrasing, but to which I responded, like, this assumes that Republican voters prioritize accomplishment. Like, they don't. Like, there is no reason to believe that you will be rewarded for actually doing the culture war things you say you're going to do.
You know what I think is devastating in the Trump response to DeSantis is using the 2018 gubernatorial ad of DeSantis talking to his baby about Trump, because DeSantis looks like such a doofy loser, such a lick spittle in doing that.
It was a shameful, humiliating, lame ad. And even though I would vote for DeSantis over Trump, like, DeSantis owns that, and he invited that. He opened the door for that, and it doesn't bother me one bit that it's coming back to hurt him, because it was a disgusting, humiliating thing he did to himself and his family. By the way, bringing your family into that is not great either.
And so I just think, you know, Trump is, I mean, they're both bullies, and all bullies are insecure at their core, but I think Trump hides his insecurity much more than DeSantis does. I think, you know, Trump seems a more authentic bully, and has a longer track record of driving the media and the left insane. And it seems like that ad makes DeSantis seem like the Johnny Come Lately trying to copy Trump, puts this veneer of phoniness over what he's doing, which I think makes it harder for DeSantis to say, "I'm going to be the better fighter than you." When you're like, I've seen Trump fight for a very long time. I saw Trump fight. He was calling Obama a non-American back in 2011. Like, he's been in this a long time. And now you're going to tell me he's not good enough at it? That seems like a very hard case to make.
But I mean, trolling people on the internet is not accomplishing things. It's not changing public policy. It's not implementing or enacting law. It's not even necessarily changing the culture. I mean, it can. So I think that's the distinction DeSantis is trying to make. And I do think it's more effective than trying to out conservative Trump. But, you know, it may not be enough. And in fact, my sense as of today, as of the last few weeks, as of the last month, at least, is that it won't be enough.
Now, we should wrap up soon, but we do have, it would seem, more candidates coming. There's talk of the North Dakota governor, Borgum, who's a billionaire, even though it's not very well, but he has money.
Not all billionaires, but all billionaires.
Pence supposedly is going to jump in soon. Chris Sununu said he's going to decide within a week or two. And we just had the news today that Chris Christie's got an announcement set up for New Hampshire next week. Now, of all those people, I mean, these are all people who are definitely not in the Trump lane, who have... But Christie has been the one who has been the in his some appearances as of late, been the most withering, the most comprehensive, the most blunt and brazen in his attacks on Trump. Now, that's given him like literally zero traction in the polls. Like, I literally see him polling at zero, maybe like one sometimes. But apparently he's got Scaramucci's money behind him. He's going to have a super PAC that some big shot donors are going to funnel money into. So, and he's got easy media access because he's been a pundit. He's good for a quote. Can he do enough damage to get those poll numbers? I mean, I don't know if we know that. Do we know what the debate threshold is? What you got to poll to get into the debates yet?
We do not. Somebody may, but we do not.
I mean, maybe, you know, Trump's got his mitts in the RNC enough where they're going to like set the bar high enough that Christie can't get in no matter how well Christie's doing. But do you think Christie can get enough traction so we can at least get on that debate stage and do what he did to Trump, what he did to Rubio 4 years ago?
I mean, I think there's a chance. I think there's a chance. With some people, I don't think there's much potential. Say, like, the North Dakota governor. But other people, I think, have a lot of potential, like this Vivek Ramaswamy. Wouldn't surprise me if he had a moment and caught fire and became somebody. And the same thing with Chris Christie. You know, he's at like 1% now or something. But he's got potential. He's got potential. Like, he could catch fire he's got personality, charisma. He's smart. He's quick-witted. And that makes him dangerous, Bill. And so I think that there's a lot of range. I think Christie could end up being a joke. And I think Christie could catch fire. I don't think he's going to be the nominee. But I think he could become very relevant because he's got the force of personality and the ability to he's very quick on his feet. So
see, I'm much less optimistic that Christie can truly catch fire. He's been around a long time. You know, his hot moment was, you know, 2011. He had the hug with Obama at the end of 2012 during the Hurricane Sandy aftermath. He ran in 2016. He's been with Trump. He's now against Trump. Like, I think he has a lack of credibility with a lot of Republican primary voters at this point that is going to be very hard for him to get over. But if he has money, and if he has a media platform, which I think at least initially he's going to have, can he get to 5%? The best hope of Christie is that he could do the murder suicide with Donald Trump and open up for somebody else.
Yeah. And the danger for Christie is that he does the same thing he did last time when he took down Marco Rubio. I mean, it's easier to take down other people. Look at Nikki Haley. She really goes after Ron DeSantis more than Donald Trump. Now, maybe she's just a stalking horse, but I think that it makes sense just strategically that even if she has her own best interest in mind, not Trump's, that you would go after DeSantis to be the take him out and try to get Trump one-on-one. That's the whole key to 2016. It could happen again. Chris Christie could get in and then find himself attacking other people as much as Trump. That would not be helpful to the goal of slaying.
No, he needs to be laser focused on Trump. And I mean, he's doing to Trump what no one else is willing to do, which is not just go at him on. He says he was ineffective on the wall. I've heard Christie say that, but he ties it to a much larger point about the sensual, disgusting element of Trump's basic character. Which ties into the fact that Trump can't win elections because he's such a horrible human being.
I have to think there is a market, an underserved, long underserved market for somebody who can viciously attack Trump pointedly and get away with it, right? And so if he can do it, then people will be stunned. It's going to attract a ton of attention and he will gain support. Frankly, just because he will have pulled off something that no one else has had the guts or the ability, which I think is part of it, actually. It's not just the guts. It's also the ability to do.
Just so you know, so Christie right now in Real Clear Politics is averaging 1%. That's because they have about four polls in the average that he was mentioned in, and in two of them he was at 2%, and two of them he was at 0%. So like, that's where Christie is at right now.
For once, I got it right. That's exactly what I said.
I think what Christie needs, like, I don't think Christie can do him by himself. I mean, I do think Christie has skills, which we saw against Rubio. I think he has an ability to kind of, you know, lock in on the weak spot and hammer it. But because, you know, Trump is so far ahead and Trump has such a broad base of support, I think the only way you dislodge that is you need an orchestra of voices in the Republican Party saying this guy is damaged goods. Like it can't be just one person. The one person can be sloughed off as being an opportunist. And Christie is an opportunist. But if he can make the case in such a compelling way that other Republicans start chiming in saying, yeah, the guy's right. And you're hearing it.
I think if DeSantis and Christie are both doing it, that would have resonance in a way that, like, if Mike Pence does it, it won't. You know what I mean?
It's going to be more than just the candidates. It's got to be other people on Fox News and other people and conservative talk radio. It can't just be like applause from the New York Times editorial page. Like, that's obviously not going to cut it. I think Republicans have to hear from other Republicans.
Yeah.
Do you remember in 2012, I heard people like say, I love that Sarah Palin, but you know she could never win. Like, Republicans would say that. Like, they'd internalize that the media would not be fair to her. Like, it reached that point. Even though they liked her, she couldn't go all the way.
And I think that was the default position of Republicans for 30 years until 20 years, mm-hmm. until Trump defied logic.
I think they got to hear from other Republicans that that's the case now for them to start recalibrating their own perceptions of things. And maybe Christie can be the initial spark, but he's going to have allies.
All right. We could keep talking, but we shouldn't. We're over an hour. Bill, stuff you want to plug?
Well, here's what I want to plug. So this is the 100th. This year is the 100th anniversary of the beginning of the Calvin Coolidge presidency. As you know, Matt, I am the vice president of the Calvin Coolidge Presidential Library and Museum Standing Committee. We're going to be doing some Coolidge 100th events over the course of the next several years. And our first one is a panel discussion about what happens when a president dies and Coolidge becomes president when Warren Harding dies. That dates August 2nd is when Harding dies, and August 3rd is when the swearing-in happens. But in advance of that, I'm having a panel with three historians who all have, I got some of the books here. So Nathan Masters, this book just came out, Crooked, which is about the Teapot Dome scandal, which Harding was in the middle of when he died. And it hadn't quite blown up yet, but Coolidge had to deal with the aftermath of it. So we'll be talking to him. Lindsay Travinsky, who just edited also a relatively new book, Mourning the Presidents. These are a collection of essays about various presidents who died, both in office and out of office, and how the nation responded to that. And Michael Gerhart, law professor at UNC. This is a bit of an older, The Forgotten Presidents, but it's a really great book. So it's covering a lot of more obscure presidents and looking at their constitutional legacies. And Coolidge is, you know, one of the people
This is a virtual interview?
This is a virtual panel. So if you want to check it out, if you go to Forbes Library is where the Calvin Coolidge Library is within. I think it's ForbesLibrary.org, if memory serves. You can go to the calendar events and you'll see the panel. And then there's a Zoom link to register for it there. And I've tweeted out and put on my Facebook page as well. So you can find it that way also.
Okay, cool. Very cool. If you send me the link, I will put it in the show notes. And of the video, and you could do it with the podcast.
So this is June 7th.
June 7th.
Okay. It's a week from today at 7 p.m. Eastern.
Sounds like fun. And by the way, I mean, if someone is listening at this point, they like what we do, and I'm guessing that they might want to watch this Zoom call with you're interviewing three historians.
Yeah.
It'll be focused on Coolidge and what happens when a president dies.
We'll get into other presidents too. So we'll start with Coolidge. Like, how did he manage this transition? People mourning Harding and then being upset about Teapot Dome. But then getting to some other transitions and how those presidents handled that.
Love it. Obviously for me, it's plugging my book. We're now 7 weeks from today is when Filthy Rich Politicians comes out. But as I've said before, if you've ever wanted to do anything to help an author, The most important thing you can do is to pre-order their book for a bunch of reasons. Number one, if you pre-order it, it's sort of like banking an early vote. It goes toward the first week's sales, which is what are compiled on bestseller lists. But it also sends a signal. If we start selling books early, pre-orders, it tells my publisher, hey, this could be a big hit. We better put more money behind promoting it. We better do a better, you know, we better hustle to push it out there, get Matt on TV or whatever. Additionally, it sends a signal to like bookstores. Hey, people are buying this. We better stock up. We better have enough for our shelves. We better put it in a prominent location at the bookstore. So please pre-order it. And the cool thing is, if you go to filthyrichbook.com, if you pre-order it today, I will send you an autographed book plate. You can download the intro and chapter one right away and start reading the book immediately. And number three, Bill, you and I did a exclusive podcast where you asked me and we talked about the book, about the concept of filthy rich politicians and how the rich get elected and the elected get rich. So go to filthyrichbook.com and pre-order today. Claim your bonuses and hook a brother up. Thank you.
We got a lot of filthy rich politicians in the Republican primary. We got Ramaswamy and Borgum, and yep. Christie is being propped up by a bunch of fat cats. So you have lots of material going forward.
I know. My only regret is that we've stopped. I can't change the book or add anything to it.
Second edition.
Well, I'm sure the paperback will include probably a new foreword by the author if past his prologue. So you may get that. Eventually. I don't even think Ramaswamy's in the book. He could be 7 weeks from now, he could be surging. It could be a huge egg on my face.
All right. Great talking to you as always. And I'll catch you in the DMZ next week.
All right. See you guys. Bye-bye.